Welcome to Versus History with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon and welcome to Versus History. I am Dr. Elliot L. Watson, and today on Versus History, I'm very pleased to welcome Squadron Leader Ian Davies of the Royal Air Force, who flew over 100 operational sorties during the Iraq War of 2003. He's very kindly agreed to talk to us about the war and his experiences as a fast jet pilot above the skies of Iraq. How are you, Ian?
Hi, Elliot. How are you doing? It's great to have you here today.
It's beautiful here. Squadron Leader Ian Davies is going to talk to us about a number of things, but most specifically his experiences in the Iraq War. Now, I'm just going to just give a little bit of background before we get into the questions, if that's okay, Ian.
Yeah, go for it, Elliot.
Okay, so in March 2003, a coalition of forces, including troops from the US, the UK, Australia and Poland, which is something I didn't know, invaded Iraq with the intention of, according to Prime Minister Tony Blair, of disarming Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, to end Saddam Hussein's support for terrorism, and to free the Iraqi people. Now, for those of our listeners who are perhaps unfamiliar with the invasion of 2003, would you mind framing the invasion as you saw it in 2003?
Yeah, I mean, it starts, as we've discussed before, a lot earlier when in 91, when Saddam Hussein and Iraq invaded Kuwait with regards to taking... they were thinking that actually Kuwait was stealing their oil supplies. They invaded Kuwait, they were aggressive against Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Middle East, and subsequently Allied forces operated, mobilised, which was a big thing in 91, or 1990, August 1990. And subsequently we had a presence in the Middle East from then onwards, policing the southern and northern no-fly zones of Iraq to ensure that he didn't have the capability to do the same thing. And then, as you quite accurately said, for whatever reason, in March 2003, Allied forces again got to the point where Saddam Hussein, his government and the Ba'ath Party and his military began posturing a lot more aggressively, and Allied forces entered Iraq. And we're going to talk about what happened after that really now.
Okay, so when you say posturing, from obviously 10 years, what is it now, 15 years hindsight, when you say posturing, the reasons that Tony Blair just gave, as well as President George W. Bush, was that they were weapons of mass destruction that needed to be disarmed. At that point in time, in 2003, was that your understanding of why you were there?
Yes, I mean, there was a southern and a northern no-fly zone that was set up after the 1990-91 conflict to prevent Saddam Hussein and his government and his military from moving vehicles, from moving military assets further towards the Saudi Arabian and the Kuwait border. He continued to do this, and over that southern no-fly zone, we very regularly engaged Iraqi military targets. At the time, flew operations over Iraq in 2001 and 2003, and at the time we were fully in the belief that he had a capable weapons of mass destruction capability, WMD capability, and that he was prepared to use it against other Middle Eastern nations and potentially against other Allied nations, and certainly against Allied forces on the ground. We were NBC nuclear, biological and chemical trained. We had our kit with us.
What does NBC mean?
Nuclear, biological and chemical warfare.
Sorry, okay.
So we had that kit with us, and it was an active threat. We had it with us at a lot of the time when we were operating out of there. So at the time, December 2002, when I was out there, he was a credible threat, and we all genuinely believed that he had the capability and, more importantly, the will to initiate an attack with weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, so would you like, can you just narrow this down now? Because you were squadron leader, and you've spoken to me about how you flew fast jet Tornado GR4s. What specifically was your role as squadron leader, as an RAF pilot, in the conflagration of 2003?
Yeah, it's probably good to say that I left the Air Force 8 years ago. So I was a squadron leader when I left eight years ago. Yeah, so in 2002, I was a junior pilot on 14 Squadron, one of the squadrons in the Royal Air Force, flying Tornado GR4 bombers. at that stage, as I said earlier, they held the ground, we held the air. It was a no-fly zone. We didn't have boots on the ground in the southern area of Iraq. So we were flying presence missions, is probably a good thing to say.
Could you explain what that is?
Dominating the air. It's no point in operating or putting a line across the map and saying this is a no-fly zone that you're not going to fly in. We have to put Allied aircraft into that no-fly zone as an active deterrent to stop him coming in. So every day we would marshal in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, a package of aircraft, which is a group of Allied aircraft of all different variants and types, up to 50, 60, maybe even 80 aircraft.
Wow.
There'd be reconnaissance aircraft, there would be electronic intelligence aircraft, which look at radar signatures of radar systems on the ground. And we would have a pretty good picture of what he was doing with his forces. If he scrambled an aircraft that entered the southern no-fly zone, then we would scramble an aircraft to intercept that, because one of the United Nations resolutions stipulated that he was not meant to be flying in there.
Right.
So that was our daily job in 2000, up to 2002, actually up until March 2003, mm-hmm. when eventually the Allies had enough of what he was doing. The Tornado's role itself at that stage was predominantly a strike role. We were given a target, which we'd sometimes be know the day before that we were going to attack. We were given a target that sometimes we just have in our back pocket, and it would be sat there for a couple of days.
Uh-huh.
But when he did something against the resolution, then we would be actioned against it. And those targets could be an air defense operations center. It could be a mobile surface-to-air missile system. Anything that tactically, either a strategic tactic that we thought could degrade his capability to do what harm against us, basically.
Wow. So as a Tornado GR4 pilot, and I'm saying that as if I really know what that means, and I don't quite, although I do know what a Tornado is, are there any experiences that you had or contributions that you made that you're allowed to speak about that perhaps stand out for either their significance in terms of their impact on operations or their significance in terms of your experiences as a pilot?
Yeah, I mean, my biggest line that I'd say to a lot of people is we were just the tip of the politician's sword. At the end of the day, there was me, a good friend of mine in the back cockpit of that Tornado, 30 million pound aircraft, 20,000 feet, and we were going across a line in the sand into a country where someone was trying to shoot us down. There'd be four of us in a formation, so there'd be four pilots, four navigators working together. It's a fantastic experience, and we did many, many missions. And there's a couple that sort of spring to mind. We did I remember doing one stage, we're over the border in Iraq in the southern no-fly zone, and we were doing a standard reconnaissance task. So two of the aircraft in the formation have a camera on the bottom of the aircraft, and uh-huh. they take pictures of his force disposition at certain areas. We would often be aware that he was looking at us, shall we say, with radar systems and also with surface-to-air missile systems.
And how would you be aware of that?
We have something called a radar homing warning receiver, which receives RF, radar frequency energy.
Okay.
So that would tell us that a certain surface-to-air missile system is active and looking at us.
Oh.
They would see us on their recognized air picture, which is if you think of a civilian radar at Heathrow Airport, it can see absolutely every aircraft within a certain radius. They had exactly the same in Iraq. There
right.
were flights going into Basra International Airport, and they had exactly the same. So they'd know we were coming, they'd know what height we were at, they'd see where we were, and then they would cue one of their surface-to-air missile systems, which was quite capable of shooting us down. Some days they would cue it to us, and they would posture and attempt to shoot us down.
Uh-huh.
Some days they wouldn't. Other days they'd actually fire missiles
right.
at us if we were threatening them.
So have you had missiles fired at you before?
Yeah, several times actually, yeah. And a lot of my colleagues, a lot more than me. The training kicks in, you go back to basics, some of the fantastic training that we get, believe it or not, more often than not in the simulator.
Uh-huh.
You use the countermeasures that we're taught, you use the electronic countermeasures on the aircraft, and if you, against certain missile systems, it's very, very capable. And that's where I think, personally, the Royal Air Force's training is second to none.
Right.
So on this specific day, there was four aircraft, two with bombs, two with cameras. We were doing a camera sortie, taking pictures, and all of a sudden, halfway through, we got re-rolled. And myself and my navigator and the other aircraft, I was number one that day, and I think it was the number three, got re-rolled. We left the southern no-fly zone. We marshalled in Kuwait, and all of a sudden we realised that we were the strike assets and the other 40 or 50 aircraft were going to come and help us. And we're right. talking, goodness me, American F-15s and F-16s. And I was a junior pilot, just coming to the end of my first tour, flying with a fantastic navigator. If he listens to this, he'll certainly know who I mean. And we were tasked against a surface-to-air missile system that had just moved into an area in the southern no-fly zone.
Uh-huh.
So one of our electronic intelligence aircraft has picked this up, knows where it is on the ground, has got a accurate position on the ground, and we're tasked against it.
Right.
So navigator does his stuff in the back, reloads the weapons, plans it all out. We get some fuel from an American air-to-air refueling tanker, and off we go and attack this surface-to-air missile system. On the way in, we got bracketed and engaged by some AAA, which is anti-aircraft artillery, so big guns. So they know what height we're at.
Right.
They fire a shell at us, and that shell is fused to go off at the height which they know that we're at.
So they fired that, or they
yeah.
locked on to fire that?
They fired it.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. And we got into the target. We dropped our weapon, which was something called an Enhanced Paveway 2, which is a GPS 1,000-pound munition. And it was actually, they'd only been in service for about 6 to 8 months. It was the first one I'd ever dropped. As it comes off the aircraft, it feels like you've just gone over the largest speed bump at about 50 miles an hour. And then as we came away from the target, I think they realized we were engaging them, so they tried to engage us, and we disappeared. As we left the southern no-fly zone, we got attacked by AAA again. And then we both realized that we were very low on fuel, myself and my wingman, and with some fantastic support from the Royal Air Force air-to-air refueling tankers and the American air-to-air refueling tankers, they came and met us. They definitely didn't cross the border into Iraq, because that would have been illegal for them, but they were amazing. And
okay.
we refueled, and while we were refueling, we got retasked to another task.
So as soon as you'd finished that one and refueled, you were then given another task to go back in.
Yeah, and it was quite busy at that stage. I think the funny thing about that is that when we landed at the end of the day, we came down, we debriefed, which takes a good few hours. At that stage, it was probably one of the longest tornado missions I'd done. It was about 4 hours long.
Wow.
And then I think one of my friends said, come on, let's go to the American food hall, which there was on the base in Kuwait at the time, and have a steak or something. And we sat there having a steak, and we looked at the TV on the wall at CNN, and the chap on CNN was saying, coalition forces struck Iraqi assets that had postured south. And we looked at this and went, oh my goodness, that was us.
Wow.
So the bombs that they were talking about were the bombs that we dropped, but actually it was a coalition effort with the 40 aircraft that supported us. And that was probably when I realized, actually, you are the tip of the politician's sword.
Yes.
And anything that UK PLC does around the globe is backed up by, partly by our military and our capability, both as an economic power, but also as a military power as well.
So when you say UK PLC, I've heard you use that before. What do you mean by that?
Well, the UK on the world stage isn't just a military power. It's a very strong economic power. You know,
right.
At the minute we're talking about Brexit, and we're talking about how the European Union doesn't want us to leave because we're economically strong. If we leave the European Union, we're not going to go and bomb them. So militarily, there is no aspect to that.
Right, okay.
But so UK PLC, in my eyes, is the UK, the Great Britain, and how it affects itself on the world stage, economically, politically, but also militarily. Because
right.
at the end of the day, there are people out there who want to do harm to us, and therefore we have to be able to, A, defend ourselves, but also, B, if the need is there, we have to be able to strike back as well.
Okay, so PLC is a term that is in common usage in the military?
Probably
that...
just actually me.
Yeah. You mentioned just before, you said the word fantastic. And you meant it in the sense of an experience. Were there any points in your sorties above Iraq, or even on the ground, where you feared that perhaps this was it, that you weren't going to survive it?
Do you know what? No, never. Even when we had missiles launched against us and against my friends, no, I was really lucky in the fact that I never got into that situation. The missions I'm talking about at the end of 2002 with 14 Squadron, when the war started in at the start of 2003. My squadron had just left theatre.
Right.
And I certainly know that my friends and colleagues who went in on day one, night one, night two, night three in March 2003, they had a completely different picture.
Right.
He threw everything, including the kitchen sink, at them. And we lost friends during that conflict in many different guises. But those chaps on night one, night two, night three, and actually for the rest of the conflict, they had surface-to-air missiles, they had AAA very accurately aimed at them, and they were, you know, it's not meant to sound heroic. They were defending for their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of them then, after defending against missile shots, went on and prosecuted their targets. Something that myself and the rest of the guys on my squadron at the time really wanted to be involved in. And when the boys came back and we spoke to them, you know, we realised. But for myself, the training kicks in, and it's relatively simple. You just take it down to basic principles. If a missile comes up, you know exactly what you need to do. Mm-hmm. You manoeuvre the aircraft, you deploy with the help of the navigator, you deploy the countermeasures that we have on the aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Which would include?
Electronic countermeasures that would try and jam the radar signature of the system on the ground that was guiding the missile in. We would have something called chaff, which was developed in World War II and called window in those days.
Yes.
We would deploy chaff, which would provide, let's say, a metallic reflective area, which mm-hmm. the missile would hopefully lock onto, and then we would maneuver as well.
Sure.
And those three things together against some of the missile systems would hopefully create a big enough miss distance. So we want it to actually, it can still explode within 100 metres of us, but certain missiles we don't want to explode within 50 or 40 or 30. So it depends what missile system it is. So as long as you can create a large enough miss distance, then you've beaten the threat, and then you're looking at the next one that's coming up, because he's probably throwing another one at you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
So no, I'm really lucky. I never got into that situation, but I know many of my colleagues who did, and yeah, count myself quite lucky on that.
Okay, phenomenal experiences. Now, because this is a history podcast, upon reflection, so looking back through the lens of history, how would you judge the Iraq War, perhaps the reasons given for going in, and the deposing of Saddam Hussein? Without getting too political,
in terms of
historical.
As I say, I am now a civilian. I'm an airline pilot. I was a squadron leader. At the time, we all fully believed. We took pictures of what we thought were his weapons of mass destruction. He was posturing in a very aggressive way. He wasn't saying to people, I don't have these things. He was actually saying, you know, I do have them, and I can do this to you. Our intelligence backed it up. And, you know, I was only at the time a flight lieutenant. We believed in 100% in what we were doing. And the guys who went in March 2003, mm-hmm. and also the Allied forces on the ground, because they did as big, if not bigger, job than we did, they fully believed. We all believed in what we were doing. Now, looking back, hindsight is certainly perfect vision, 20/20 vision. Now we talk about regime change. Was that the reason that we were going in there? We look at the analysis of the intelligence, and was it at fault? For me, I am a big believer in what has it left. It left a huge vacuum in Iraq. The people of Iraq, who are just like you and me, their fathers, their brothers, they've got families. It left a huge chasm and massive, massive issues in Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is a huge entity. They're very aggressive. We look at ISIS or Daesh. So when I look back, and I look back at least Saddam Hussein, through very harsh means, kept a country together.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say, would it have been better if he'd stayed in? On a personal level, I had many friends who died in the conflict and since then. Was their sacrifice worth it? Mm-hmm. I think personally, as an ex-military guy, you have to believe that it was worth it.
Right.
But I look at it now and I feel that we would feel like it was a job well done if Iraq was in a state of harmony at the minute, and it isn't.
Yes.
So personally, you know, there was a lot of things afterwards that we believed in that were found out to be untrue.
Okay.
And that's predominantly the weapons of mass destruction.
Sure. Okay.
That's my opinion anyway.
Right, well, that's why we're here, to get your opinion. Last question. This year saw the 100th anniversary of the RAF, the Royal Air Force.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd end with this question. How would you assess the value or the contributions of the RAF to the defence of the UK or even the national character of the UK, either historically or currently?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm phenomenally proud to have been part of a fifth of the Air Force's history, and there's friends of mine who've been part of a lot more. Their contribution to our defence in the last 100 years has been phenomenal, but so has the naval and the ground forces, the army's contribution. Yeah. I think at the minute the biggest thing is the money situation. Politicians and senior military officers always want a bigger slice of the money that's allocated to the UK defence budget. And at the minute, with the new brand new F-35 Lightning costing $80 to $100 million, yeah, Typhoon costs $125 million. Tornado, at its time, its first flight was in 1974, only cost $30 million.
That's per plane.
Aircraft. Yeah, right. Yeah, and those aircraft are all amazing. I mean, the Tornado has been in action now for goodness me, over 30 years. Mm. It's changed. Its role has changed significantly from strike, low-level nuclear strike, to close air support, which is 8 hours over Iraq, helping the guys on the ground out. Uh-huh. And when I used to teach this, I'd say to my students, listen, don't think that you're a fighter pilot that you've seen in Top Gun. That doesn't happen anymore.
Right.
You are a toolbox. And when the boys on the ground can't crack the nut they need to crack, i.e. take an objective because they haven't got sufficient firepower, then they're going to call the toolbox that they can get, which is us in the air, and we'll be there within 10 or 15 minutes. Uh-huh. They'll talk us onto a target. So, you know, the Tornado's been amazing. Typhoon is doing that role now. The F-35 is becoming combat ready. That is a very, very expensive slice of the pie at the minute. We've been on operations over against Daesh in all over the Middle East for the last, since August 2014. You know, it's a projection of force. The Air Force can take anybody anywhere pretty quickly. So if we need to get to, for example, East Timor, or if we need to get to Belize, then we can project the force, i.e. we can take the guys on the ground and put them in there. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean landing on a runway. I mean inserting them from 24,000 feet, dropping them out of the back of a helicopter, inserting special forces troops so no one knows. Rapid deployment of assets is essential. God, I'm blaring. Defence of the Nation. QRA, quick response alert. It was born in the Battle of Britain. Fantastic Spitfire and Hurricane pilots sat there, the new chain home radar system looking in the direction of Europe, and a 200 bomber attack coming in, and off they go. Mm-hmm. Our contribution has been evident. Battle of Britain, Falklands War, the nuclear deterrent, it's immense. So the value of the Air Force per se will be argued, and Naval Admiral will argue that it's not as important as the Navy. An army brigadier will argue it's not as important as the army.
Sure.
I think together, seamlessly, hopefully, the three unities will work together. But I don't think objectively you can look at the Royal Air Force over the last 100 years and sit there and say that we have the country we have today, speaking the language we have today, and with the political and military power worldwide, we would not have that without the Royal Air Force, the crews that have crewed the aircraft, the guys on the ground and the girls who have serviced, maintained the aircraft, and the support structure behind it.
Okay.
So yeah, I personally am a big believer that the last 100 years are the start of the next 100 years, and the F-35 is the next platform to go forward with that.
Wow. Well, that was phenomenal. That was phenomenal. I think that's probably the first time in Versus history that we've actually had an individual that is has been so directly involved in an historical event or narrative that the students actually now study at A level and IB and even at GCSE, both the Iraq wars. So, squadron leader retired, is that correct?
Yeah, it would be retired.
Retired,
yeah.
Ian Davies, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Alex.
This is Dr. Elliot L. Watson saying goodbye from Versus History and.
Goodbye, guys.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for downloading and listening to this edition of Versus History. Subscribe, visit us at our website, www.versushistory.com.